You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, good morning. We're going to go ahead and kick off the Wednesday show today talking about an uncomfortable conversation, the Catholic Church, priests, and child abuse.
The Lead. Brought to you by Burge Ford off the US 60 and Mesa Drive.
Well, it is the first of its kind in the United States. A state, Pennsylvania, spent 2 years investigating sexual abuse within the Roman Catholic Church and the subsequent cover-up by the bishops and other leaders. The 800-page report details the sexual abuse at the hands of 300 priests over the course of 70 years. The grand jury report found that more than 1,000 victims, and they said there are likely more victims, thousands more, whose records were lost or were too afraid to come forward.
Yeah, the numbers are staggering, Pamela. And if these were numbers nationwide, they would be staggering. These are numbers for the state of Pennsylvania only. The state of Pennsylvania conducted this investigation. It is, what, like a 1,400-page report? It goes back 70 years. And details and documents abuse of children only in the state of Pennsylvania with numbers that I just think most people struggle to understand.
The Pennsylvania grand jury report found that several hundred Catholic priests got away with child sex assault.
Senior church officials covered up their criminal conduct.
Pennsylvania prosecutor Josh Shapiro says many of the priests won't face prosecution because of the statute of limitations. Pittsburgh Bishop David Zubik says they've changed many things to protect children.
Doing everything possible to prevent such abuse from ever happening again.
Yeah, you're not doing everything possible. Okay, you're not.
Yeah, let's be honest about
as a what I call recovering Catholic, to be perfectly honest with our listening audience right now, born and raised Catholic, Roman Catholic in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Right in this, right.
And I just literally went through the 100, yes, 100 names of priests within the Pittsburgh diocese that have been named in this grand jury report. Why? I wanted to see if any of them were at St. Francis.
Yeah.
Church that I attended for all those years, 18 years. I call myself a recovering Catholic because when this story first broke years ago.
And literally, I don't remember. I mean, but you know.
I was
in
college.
This is deja vu, isn't it? This is all over again. I thought we've already had this story once.
No, we've never had this story because while you have had individual dioceses investigate, you have had individual counties investigate, you have never once had a state investigate all dioceses, all counties within that state and have a comprehensive report. This has never been done. And when it's done in the state of Pennsylvania, we come back with 300 priests over a period of 70 years abusing an identifiable 1,000 children and noting that there are probably thousands more whose records were lost and were too afraid to come forward. This is Pennsylvania. What if you did this all across the country?
Well, that's the thing. What they came out with by doing the math was that roughly 5%, this is from the state attorney general, 5% of Catholic priests in the state of Pennsylvania are accused, charged, believed to have abused children. 5%. If you extrapolate that just today, across the United States, if you looked at all 50 states and District of Columbia, you'd be looking at roughly 20,000 Catholic priests if the numbers in Pennsylvania extrapolated to the United States.
And so why am I so fired up about this? I mean, this hits home for me, and it's disgusting. This report is disgusting. It is graphic. And there are certain aspects about it we can't tell you about on the radio, folks, because it is too graphic. But if you do have children in the car right now, I want to warn you because it is important to give you the breadth and the scope of what's in it and why people are so fired up. So if you do have children in the car, turn down the radio for the next 42 seconds as I play you this soundbite.
One victim was a little girl. And she first remembers when she was a little girl at catechism class, sitting on the lap of the priest and being touched inappropriately. And then, when she was 7 years old, she was in the hospital having her tonsils removed. That same priest came to the hospital to pay a visit. He raped her, according to the report. And then when she was 13 years old, that same priest, she alleges, came to her home when her parents were away and raped her again. And then when she was 19 years old and pregnant, that very same priest, according to this report, raped her another time.
This is criminal behavior. This is predatory criminal behavior. And it shows a criminal conspiracy inside the Catholic Church to prevent people like that specific priest from receiving the justice he so greatly deserves.
So how could I possibly be a part of an institution that operates that way?
Yeah.
You said 5%. This equates to about 5%.
In the state of Pennsylvania.
Which is where right. I was a Catholic.
There was 3,000. What was the number?
So you had fathers.
1,000, yeah.
Priests who stood on the altar every Sunday preaching their sermon of what is right and wrong, all while 5% of them were raping boys and girls. And you're a man of God? You're not a man of God. You're a monster. And this is an institutional, systematic cover-up of those monsters.
There were secret archives in every diocese where there was documentation of the abuse, but only the bishop in the diocese would have the key. And it remained secret for so long.
You got to believe that other people inside the church, Pamela, at least had suspicions. At least thought something was going on. There are people who are complicit in this all throughout the church who saw something and didn't say something. Do you know what I mean? Like yes, there are the criminals and the priests who committed these crimes are wholly responsible for their criminal actions. There are other people complicit in covering it up. And one of the things that I found, like, it's like every other sentence of this, you find something that shocks you a little bit more. That some of these priests won't ever see justice.
You want to talk about that? Let's take a listen.
Because of the statute of limitations.
The cover-up was so expansive, the statute of limitations has run. 301 priests, credible evidence, only two at this point can be prosecuted. The investigation continues, though.
I don't even know why there's a statute of limitations on these.
And that's the recommendation. The grand jurors are saying there should not be statute of limitations for child sexual abuse in Pennsylvania.
301 priests.
Yeah.
Two fall within the statute of limitations. Now, granted, a lot of these priests are dead.
Because the allegations
go back 70 years.
70 years, so I can acknowledge
okay.
that.
But how do you have a statute of limitation on this? Grand jury is pushing to change it. It's going to be tough to change in the state of Pennsylvania. Roman Catholic, the Catholic religion in the state of Pennsylvania is the most dominant. I think I saw a number. It's either 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 individuals okay. in the state of Pennsylvania belong to the Catholic Church. That is going to be a huge haul for the state legislature to do anything about. But how can you not? How can you not?
The denials from inside the Catholic Church are thankfully falling on a lot of deaf ears. Bishop Zubik from Pittsburgh said there was no cover-up going on.
Bull. Bishop Worrell was before him. Bishop Worrell was in Pittsburgh for 15 to 18 years. It is detailed in here some of the cases where he did punish priests and others that he transferred to other parishioners.
When it got too hot for
him.
Yeah.
He is now a cardinal.
He said, I think it's important to be able to state that we have, over the course of the last 30 years, for sure been transparent about everything that has, in fact, been transpiring. The grand jury begs to differ, and the evidence does not show that you have been transparent and doing everything. The investigation shows that there was, again, a criminal conspiracy to cover up child sex abuse inside the Catholic Church because of how it would make them look, they wanted to make sure it didn't see the light of day.
I had my first communion. I made my confirmation. I'm currently a recovering Catholic, but I want to hear from those who are current practicing Catholics. What are your thoughts on this? We're going to give you a chance to chime in on our open mic line, 602-200-2733, 602-200-2733, and the open mic line brought to you by Carol Royce with Keller Williams Realty East Valley.
You know, there isn't a lot of video around, Pamela, of medieval peasants. So I'm just going to have to go with like Monty Python movies with what it was like to be a medieval peasant. But we are finding out that you, Americans, take less holiday, take fewer vacation than medieval peasants do? You've got to be kidding me. The lead brought to you by Burge Ford off the US 60 and Mesa Drive, online at burgeford.com.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Okay, I acknowledge that I don't think I want to go back in time and be a medieval peasant. I'm led to believe that things like disease, famine, and bloody holy wars were bad for you. That your life expectancy was decidedly lower in medieval times. But there were some positives, Pamela. One of the positives were that medieval peasants, yes, medieval peasants got more time off of work.
What?
Got more vacation time.
What? The average, like, yeah. we are taking less time off, like holidays, vacation. Than a medieval peasant? How do they measure this stuff? I mean, come on, really?
Well, they said that Sundays, nobody ever worked on Sunday.
Sabbath, yeah.
In medieval times. And there were harvesting seasons. You know, we even know like school
summer vacation
are based around the traditional harvesting. And that after harvesting season, they gave everybody a break because they've been working so hard in the fields. You got mandatory breaks. Yes. They say that going back to the 14th century, peasants worked no more than 150 days a year.
Oh, my goodness. It's like a like a school year for kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You work 3 days a week, maybe four. Right?
But then you find out that like nowadays, we, because this isn't like... Oh, society does this. No, Americans do this.
It is uniquely American.
It is uniquely American in the sense that we don't take off our vacation days. Well, we don't use our holidays.
Well, and Pamela, it's not that we don't even use them. We have a culture of we don't even get them. And I use an example.
What do you mean get them?
We don't have, and I'm not looking for mandated holiday and government. No. But... it is not part of our culture to take time off the way that others do. I use my family in Germany as an example. I never understood it. Like, I thought for the longest time that my uncle and my cousins must be really, really rich. And here's why I thought that. They used to take August off.
Like the entire month?
They would go on vacation.
No, they'd go on holiday. They call it holiday.
For the month of August. And I was like... I mean, this was 10 years ago still. I was like, okay, explain to me again how you take an entire month away from work, school, everything. And they're like, well, we go to Switzerland and then we go to this. I go, how do you take a month off? And they looked at me like, how do you not take a month off? And I was like, I just don't get it. Other cultures, other countries think we're the crazy ones.
Well, I think we're the crazy ones, too. I like what they do over there in Europe.
Take
as far
off
as-
August.
Absolutely.
Oh, for August. We're leaving.
Okay, so yes, they have, you know, the government mandated, and they've got the, you know, government policies that are literally in place in some of these countries, of which we don't have one in the United States. But is there a difference in fear between the United States and in Europe? Play along with me here. 60% of employees here in America that were surveyed said the reason they don't take their vacation time, the time that they are given, I'm not talking about taking the month of August off.
Okay.
I'm telling about when you get hired for a job and they're like, okay, you get 2 weeks vacation.
Yeah,
and then after you're there for a couple, okay, now you
got
you
a
get
third
3 weeks.
What?
And if you're there even longer, You get 4 weeks.
Oh, my.
All right,
Atlanta.
Yeah, to get 4 weeks vacation. Think about it, to get 4 weeks. But
the month of
60% of employees say that they don't even take that vacation that's allotted to them. Why? The fear of looking replaceable. 55% say, well, my workload is too heavy.
You know, I and this is not to justify it, because I think that there are different job situations, and it's easy for us to say this, and I know there's a lot of people out there going, you're in my situation. As a manager, it was difficult to take holidays and vacation. And for me, I couldn't, when I was running back in the day, when I was barista for the boss, it was difficult to go away for a week, because all I could think about is what my desk would look like and what my voicemail inbox would be like when I came back.
See, I'm just...
It wasn't worth
leaving. I'm doing so much better at just leaving work at work.
Yeah.
You're not paying me while I'm on vacation to worry about work.
Yeah.
I'll worry about work when I get back to work, and you pay me to worry about it.
I worry a lot less now, but then again, I don't have to sit in the conference room like our boss does or do budgets. Do you know what I'm saying? I worry a lot less, and I think about it a lot less, but there are some jobs out there where I used to say, it's not worth going on vacation. It's not worth being gone a week.
If we took
it's a
holiday,
month of hell after it.
Some time to celebrate.
Oh, my Lanta. Or?
Just a day out of life.
Like my German side of the family? Yeah, we're gone for August. Excuse me? And by the way, they have other vacations and holidays all during the year. But we take August off.
I gotta move to Germany.
I was like, are you guys billionaires? Tell me. Like, everybody takes a month off. What? Sprechen Sie Deutsch? Guten Tag? I need to learn that a little more. We have a story, disturbing, kind of crazy, of a girl who says she had to escape from a hospital in the United States. We'll tell you about that story coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
You know, we hear a lot of stories about medicine and medical care. A lot of them revolve around insurance and being able to pay for it. I want to put that aside for a second, though, and talk about a story. A story of a patient, a family, and their struggle inside a major, well-respected American hospital. And this is not a story that involves who's going to pay for it or being able to afford it. This comes down to, who do you trust? How do you know you can trust them? And when do you get to make your own decisions about your medical care?
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating story. It was an exclusive on CNN, and it's called Escape from the Mayo Clinic. And we have a Mayo Clinic
right here
in the Valley.
We have a Mayo here. It's a fantastic facility. Right?
This is not one that took place in the Valley. This is one that took place in Minnesota. Okay. So important to point that out. But here's a little bit of what happened.
On Christmas Day, a blood vessel burst inside her brain. She had emergency surgery at the Mayo Clinic. Doctors gave her a 2% chance of surviving. Whoa. After a month, she moved to the rehabilitation unit at Mayo with new doctors.
And okay, so the family actually wanted their daughter, Alyssa, who's 18, to go to the Mayo Clinic. That Christmas night, there was an ice storm. The only hospital they could get to was their local hospital. They fought to get her transferred to the Mayo Clinic because it is a world-renowned
facility. We want the best
facility.
For our daughter.
They had to wait for the weather to calm down, and then she got transferred. 2% chance of survival, and because of the amazing doctors there, she survived.
Ta-da.
She then gets moved to the rehabilitation floor, and that's where the tensions really started.
You go from the ICU, you stabilized, and they move.
The tension eventually exploded, and Mayo kicked Alyssa's mother out of the hospital after they say she interrupted a meeting. In a statement, Mayo told us family members may be restricted in situations where care may be compromised or the safety and security of our staff are potentially at risk. Alyssa's mother says she didn't do either.
So, what do we do now? Well, they wanted to get her out.
Did you want out of the Mayo Clinic?
As bad as possible, yes.
But what happened next is alarming. Alyssa and her parents say Mayo wouldn't let her go.
Did you ask to have her transferred to another hospital?
We did.
And what did Mayo say?
They said no.
A lawyer even wrote this letter asking for an expedited transfer to another hospital.
It felt like you went from a healing place to a prison.
They call it medical kidnapping. And they actually started to decrease the amount of time that the parents could be near their daughter. They actually tried to say that their daughter or that the patient, the 18-year-old, was incapable of making her own decisions. They wanted her to become somebody who they were making the decisions for and taking the parental rights out of it. So they developed an escape plan.
So Alyssa's parents hatched an escape plan. They pulled a trick on the staff to get her out of Mayo, and they documented it on video. They told them that Alyssa's grandma, Betty, had come to visit, but was too frail to come inside the hospital. And so Alyssa had to come to her.
So they basically sprung her out of the hospital. You know, what I take from this is we give a lot of deference to doctors, and you and I both know that we have Dr. Simpson on the show all the time, and we've even spoken to him about this a little bit, about people are in some cases very hesitant to question doctors.
Sure, yeah.
Doctors know best. They told you this, therefore it is true, you know, and you're not allowed to question it, but confident, good doctors have no problem with you questioning it. They have no problem with second opinions. They have no problem with exploring other opportunities. They don't have that God complex.
So as I'm following this story, you know, parents spring their daughter. I'm going, okay, that takes some guts, because if it's my daughter who's had this kind of medical issue and I'm at the Mayo Clinic and they say that she needs to be here, you're thinking that she needs to be here. What kind of risk am I taking by taking her out of the hospital? Well, the hospital called 911. There were three different police agencies that were trying to track down this family.
They're searching
because
for
they thought her life was in jeopardy. Parents eventually got her to another hospital. And what was amazing about all of this, Bruce, because I think this is important for people to understand, that the doctors at this new hospital in Sanford Medical Center in Sioux Falls, it's a teaching hospital for the University of South Dakota, they explained everything that was going on, why they left the Mayo against medical advice. And the doctors there, although the Mayo doctors insisted this girl needed to be in the hospital, the doctors there came to the total opposite conclusion. They gave her medication, gave her instructions to follow up with the doctor, and told her to go home.
Wow. And I mean, this isn't just a doctor with a differing opinion. This is a doctor with a completely different prognosis, 180 degree difference. You know what it struck me as? It struck me that I've heard people before. What is the term? You need to be your own
advocate.
You need to be your own advocate.
Yeah.
Thank you. And sometimes you get a second opinion. It's almost like you need to have a friend, you need to have a trusted partner who understands this system.
But it's not just like your husband.
No.
Or your best friend.
I count myself lucky. If I were to have some sort of medical issue today, which, of course, there's always a chance. I've seen me. I would probably go to Dr. Simpson. Mm-hmm. If I was in a hospital, I would either ask for or I would text him. Doc Simpson would text or call me back, and he would meet me there, and I'd say, I need you to explain this to me and make sure this is what I think it is. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right,
because I personally
know
him, and he has no vested interest in this other system. He's going to be my advocate. It's like if you're buying a car, you take the car to your mechanic. You don't trust their mechanic.
Yeah, but how many people actually have a medical expert in their corner that can do that for them?
Yeah.
It's sad that you need that, but I've been in situations just in the last year where, yeah, I've had to question doctors. They do not like
it. It's uncomfortable.
But guess what? My body, my health, my concern.
Not everybody's that strong.
Oh, I understand. No, and I was not always that strong. Yeah. I had to learn from my mistakes before I got to that point, Bruce.
No. The state of California is fighting some pretty serious wildfires, and they have a tactic. But is the tactic exploitation? Prison inmates fighting forest fires. We'll talk about it next.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
We've talked about and we're familiar of some of the tragedies regarding the California wildfires. We have hundreds of thousands of acres destroyed, property, buildings, you know, again, paling in comparison to the lives lost in there. But I saw something that I thought was kind of interesting. So the Mendocino complex fires are at about 350,000 acres.
Good night.
There's over 1,000 structures that continue to be threatened, possibly in the way, if you will. This is up in the Northern California area. Think Redding, California. And we know that there are tons of firefighters, including many from right here in Arizona, hotshot crews and wildland firefighters who are up there fighting these fires.
When you've got a 350,000 acre wildfire, you're going to need a lot of resources. So there's roughly 14,000 firefighters on those fires as well as others across the region. Now, what you may not know
is amongst 14,000 firefighters, right? 2,000 of them, well, they're not your average firefighter. They're not your average bear.
In addition to roughly 7,000 full-time and seasonal California firefighters, the state relies on about 3,500 prisoners, including many women, to battle the blazes. The California Department of Corrections tweeted last week that at least 2,000 prisoners are currently fighting the wildfires burning across the state, including 58 youth offenders.
All right, so you now have inmates. This is not unusual. In fact, I think it's happened right here in Arizona at some point in time.
I believe so.
But you have inmates who are helping to battle those wildfires. Now, they volunteer to go do it.
I think that's really important because there is a history of, what do you want to call it, prison labor that's sketchy.
Yeah.
To say the least.
These inmates, though.
In an interview, Bill Sessa, spokesman for CDCR, stated all of the inmates are volunteers and, quote, the program saves the state $90 to $100 million a year.
Okay, how does the state save that much money? Well, they save it because those 2,000 inmates that have voluntarily gone to fight alongside the firefighters. I say alongside, they're not really fighting alongside. We'll get to that in a second. But they're getting paid. They're getting paid.
Okay.
A dollar an hour.
That's while I use the term professional. I'm not meaning to demean them, make a lot more per hour.
According to the California Fire Agency, professional firefighters are paid anywhere from $11 to $62 an hour, while inmates are making at most a dollar per hour.
So some people take this as a form of outrage, and I guess I'm not on the outrage side. I would think you'd have a solid argument to argue about and think this is horrible if inmates were being forced to fight wildfires.
Yeah, they're getting plucked out of their bunks and saying, hey,
you,
get over there.
Put on the yellow helmet and get out. Here's a shovel. Good luck. By the way, it's hot. There's a couple of things about it. You made mention that when you think of, and I hope you do, when you think of wildland firefighters, a lot of us think of the hotshot crews. They are like the Green Berets of the military.
Yeah, they're the ones on the front line.
Do you know what I'm saying? They're the Navy SEALs. They are specially trained, highly trained. They are the ones literally on the front lines. Now, just like in the military, hey, there's also cooks. There's also people that fix the trucks in the back, and they're saying that a lot of these prison inmates are doing some of the behind the scenes work that allow these professional firefighters to work farther forward.
Right. Now they have a vital role, don't get me wrong, but
it's a job.
Clearing thick brush down the bare soil to stop the fires spread. Now, there's some history here. I mean, when this kind of program was started in the early 1900s, inmates were forced.
Okay.
To build highways and roads. They're not forced. They're getting the opportunity to volunteer, and many of them are. For me, I don't have a problem with this. The inmates that are being used, I mean, there's obviously criteria for which they have to, you know, go through. They've got to be nonviolent in their original conviction. Minimum custody status. They could not have committed arson. Well, that kind of makes sense.
That's nice. We're not going to send arsonists out to fight forest fires. Smart move.
Rape or sex offenses. If they have any medical issues, you can't go do this.
Okay.
But And a lot of these types of stories, Bruce, I put myself in the position of the person or the group of people that we're talking about. And if I'm an inmate mm-hmm. in California and I fit the criteria for somebody who has the opportunity, is given the chance to go do this, get me out of the bunk. Get me out of the cell. Get me out there and put me to work.
Yeah.
Get your mind busy.
I'm not saying they all love it, but
no.
I'm going to say some of them must say, this is better than sitting in here. Plus, and I know people that have been in jail, been in prison. There's many of them that they know they've done wrong. This is a chance to try to make things right.
A good thing? Or are they being exploited? California paying inmates $1 an hour to fight wildfires. Your thoughts. We'd love to hear it on our open mic line. 602-200-2733. Good thing or exploitation? 602-200-2733.
So for the first time ever, or I should say, as far as we know, a state has a transgender nominee for governor. The world is changing around us, and it's changing pretty darn fast. We'll talk about that coming up next on Arizona's News Station.